This is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Hope Kerwin. As Wisconsin's unemployment rate continues to be at record lows, business and community leaders are taking a closer look at what challenges could be preventing people from entering or remaining in the workforce. Recently here on Newsmakers, we talked about how access to affordable childcare is impacting parents in the local workforce. And today we'll look at another challenge, access to affordable housing. Joining us to talk about the issue and what local community leaders are doing to help are Jason Gilman, Director of Planning and Development for the City of La Crosse, Liz Evans, Community Impact Director of the Great Rivers United Way, and Kaya Fox, Executive Director of the La Crosse Area Habitat for Humanity. So a recent survey of regional business executives in the Cooley region found affordable housing is now a top concern for them regarding the workforce. And Liz, I wonder if you could talk about how housing can be a barrier for people when it comes to entering or remaining in the workforce.
Sure. If people don't have stable housing, it's really hard to have a stable life. According to a recent study in the ALICE report, which stands for Asset Limited, Income Constrained, and Employed, there's about a 15% gap of affordable housing here in La Crosse County. So that means people can't afford many of the units that are available. There's just not enough stock. So that means people are moving further away from their workplace, and you know, this population, because they can't afford much more than the basics, maybe driving a car that's not as reliable. So then transportation can be iffy and is another barrier.
Jason, I wonder if you could talk a little bit about, you know, how long access to affordable housing has been a challenge in this area.
It's like anything else in economics, supply and demand, and, you know, the fact that we do have a shortage. And there's a lot of reasons for the shortage. One is, our aging society and aging in place. We've got a lot of less turnover in the market, and then we've got in construction inflation from a whole variety of things, including the environmental catastrophes in the country, like the fires and the hurricanes, you know, that are consuming more construction material. And then we have labor scarcity too, and that that is affecting contracting and then the cost of contracting. So we're not building as fast as, you know, we may need to. And that's affecting the supply. And then what happens, of course, with the housing being at a premium because of that, you end up with a less of a democratic representation of the wage structure, income structure of your community. Becomes a people are consuming more of their income, you know, having to spend on housing because of lack of supply.
That's so interesting that you bring up the fact that labor shortage in the, you know, construction area is also contributing to this affordable housing, which is an impact on the greater workforce. I mean, that seems kind of like a chicken or the egg kind of situation.
Well, it is, and I mean, there's so much complexity to this whole thing, because not only is that related, but the whole idea of labor scarcity is also related to our birth rate and death rate, you know, and we've got a lower birth rate now than we did 10 years ago. By about 100, if you look at live births in the area. And then our fertility rate is historically low. It's like 50 births per 1,000 women or something like that, which is lower than the national average. And you think about the reason why people have families, and of course economics plays into that. So you look back at the trends after the Great Recession, and you see this this trend toward not having children. And that, of course, affects our population, which affects our labor availability long-term. The competition, of course, for labor to migration plays into that. So all of these things are kind of interconnected in a very complex web.
Kaya, do you feel like this issue of affordable housing is talked about enough when we have these bigger discussions about the workforce?
I don't think we are, and I think Jason kind of alluded to it when he said it's such a complex issue. And so we talk a lot about jobs. People really are, you know, really impressed and want to know more about what are the jobs looking like, what are the incomes looking like, but we forget that piece about housing. And I think that's a piece that to forget is kind of doing a disservice, because when we pay our bills every single month, it's our housing cost that's the biggest bill that we have to pay. And so to forget about that as part of the bigger piece on how are people making their paychecks last, how are they juggling their work and their children and education all together, and to take housing out of the conversation is doing a disservice to one of the biggest issues that we have in the area.
Liz, you mentioned the ALICE report that the United Way puts together, and I just wonder if you could dig a little deeper into, you know, what ALICE measures.
Sure. ALICE report is, it paints a picture of the economic situation of folks who are living above the poverty level, but really not quite making it. So the population you would consider previously called working poor. People living paycheck to paycheck. So what the report does is it analyzes how much a person or a household would need to just barely scrape by. And in La Crosse County, a family of four needs to be making about $64,000 a year to just minimally meet their needs. And in order to thrive, they need about double that. So it encompasses a lot of the population. At least 36% in the county of La Crosse are below that ALICE threshold. In the city of La Crosse, it's 52%. So there's a lot of folks, a lot of our neighbors that are struggling to get by, and the report really does a good job of painting that picture of all of the different struggles that families have.
And how have we seen those percentages change over the years? I know the United Way has been looking at this for at least a couple years now.
Right. Since 2010, it has actually gotten a little worse. We've seen the rates of ALICE go up bit by bit over the past several years. Unfortunately, you know, that we haven't gotten quite back to where we were before the recession.
And that's really interesting, because I feel like a lot of economic conversations talk about how we have recovered after this recession, but you're saying the data doesn't necessarily support that for everybody in the community.
Right. For some people, some folks, they're still really struggling, and they're working for lower wages, sometimes two or three jobs. One of the issues is wages are lagging, and in the state, 62% of all of the jobs available pay less than $20 an hour, which makes it pretty tough if you have a family to really thrive.
How does La Crosse compare to the state, or maybe even to some of the surrounding counties that are maybe more rural than La Crosse mm-hmm. County?
Well, in some aspects, it's doing better. La Crosse is pretty much in the middle as far as the whole county. You know, we see certain counties like Milwaukee and Menominee that consistently fall below average in the state when it comes to the ALICE report. And La Crosse tends to be right there in the middle. There's, you know, a couple of the surrounding counties are doing slightly worse, slightly better. But we're all kind of in the same boat.
You're listening to Newsmakers on Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Hope Kerwin. Today we're talking about how a lack of affordable housing in and around La Crosse is impacting the regional workforce. We're here with Liz Evans from Great Rivers United Way, Kaya Fox from the La Crosse Area Habitat for Humanity, and Jason Gilman from the City of La Crosse Planning and Development Department. So, Jason, given the situation that the City of La Crosse is in when it comes to, you know, people kind of living in above the poverty line but not quite making it, you know, how has that informed the way the city looks at the issue of housing?
Well, it informs it tremendously, because we, as Kaya pointed out, you know, we look at the holistic costs of housing for people and how that contributes to either their economic security or insecurity. and what are all the inputs? So some of them are the actual mortgage or the cost of the housing itself, and how well is that designed? Are they buying something that is really not designed well, or is energy inefficient, because energy plays into it also. And then we look, you know, at accessibility. Are they close? Are there inequities present in where we're proposing housing? For instance, is it an area where there's no food access, or is it an area that's not served by public transportation? And I think all of those things contribute to whether or not somebody has more economic security or doesn't when you look at the pie chart of somebody's household budget. You know, we're working diligently to try to find redevelopment nodes, if you will, that have all of those factors. And then we're looking at how do we work through public-private partnerships to look for energy innovation and good amenities, whether it's biking and walking access or transit access, and then density too, you know, where there's a mix of densities that offer people a variety of different price points. Those are all factors that inform the city in terms of how we are doing land use planning.
You mentioned public-private partnerships, and, you know, I wonder if you could talk about how much this requires, you know, private businesses to also kind of buy in and address this issue.
Yeah, well, this is something that we've talked a lot about, because the city can't cure this problem alone. It has to be the community that really looks after it. And the city gets about $1 million a year from housing and urban development to deal with blight and poverty and create do replacement housing and rehab. But you can imagine with construction inflation, that $1 million goes pretty quick. And then the city's budget, of course, is we have a lot of demands on the city's budget due to decaying infrastructure and other issues. So the amount of money that we have to work with relative to housing is really, in the grand scheme of things, fairly small. Therein lies the challenge, I think, to the private sector, is we know that there's a nexus between attracting talent and giving people economic security and a reason that they might want to come to La Crosse and housing. So we've been looking at an opportunity with a community-based financial institution to establish a real estate investment fund that businesses can participate in to create a capital source for housing development. We think that there are, you know, we're an opportunity-rich city with regard to that. We have land in the floodplain. We have land that is, you know, part of obsolete sites like the Kmart site or, you know, retail sites that are closing. We've got excess land on brownfield sites like Riverside North, where the ExxonMobil tank farm was. So there's lots of opportunities for businesses to get involved in this equation and discussion.
Kaya, I wonder if you could talk a little bit about, you know, how Habitat for Humanity has been working to move the needle on this issue. I mean, Habitat is definitely an organization that is associated, you know, greatly with addressing the issue of affordable housing.
We started 26 years ago, and we were started by a group of citizens that were concerned about affordable housing issues in our community. They did a march across La Crosse to raise awareness about the issue for affordable housing, and 26 years later, we're still out there talking about those same issues, and we're still doing addressing the issue the same way that we did in the beginning, which is to build affordable housing for families in need in our community. I think the things that we've done differently over the years is taking a look at, with diminishing resources, how we can capitalize on partnerships with other organizations, with other nonprofit agencies, with the city, with the county, to develop housing development programs that kind of give you more bang for your buck, that we can produce more housing, that we can find innovative ways to use the land available to us. So, for example, we are just finishing up our 5th and Mississippi development here in La Crosse, and this is a 7-unit development in partnership with the City of La Crosse, the La Crosse County, CoolieCap, another housing development nonprofit organization, and the La Crosse Neighborhood Development Corporation. Corporation to partner our funds together, partner our resources, and develop 7 units of housing on a blighted piece of property in the city. And so we are moving the tax base up from about $200,000 to about $1.3 million by being able to work together. And I think those are the things that we're going to be looking at in the future. You know, instead of working independently, how can we work together to identify what are the needs in the community, and then what are those innovative ways that we can address those to make, you know, better neighborhoods, better communities, and provide housing for families.
I think a lot of people associate Habitat with building homes, like standalone single-family homes. And so I think it's interesting to hear that, you know, Habitat is looking at other kinds of housing to address this issue.
Absolutely. So we actually are hosting our final home on that corner, and it was a twin home, so a zero lot line with a shared wall. And this is a way to maximize space in the city of La Crosse and also provide opportunity for additional housing, whereas before, you know, we would have put a single family unit on that lot, and instead we're looking at ways that we can work with the city to kind of maximize that space, maximize housing, and maximize opportunities for people in our community. And that corner is actually going to have, with the total of 7 units, it's 3 twin homes. So we replaced single family homes and are putting up 2 units that are going to be available for families for purchase. And I think that's just one of those great examples of being able to partner with all these great people in the community that understand the need for affordable housing and bringing those resources together.
I wonder if you could go into a little bit more detail about, you know, who is really participating in addressing this issue in the La Crosse area.
I think, you know, when Jason was talking about how it kind of takes everybody, including local businesses, as a nonprofit organization, it is always so impressive to me how the community comes together and understands the need of affordable housing. We get a lot of support from local businesses and, you know, local foundations and other nonprofits, and it takes a lot. It takes a lot to build 7 units of housing on a corner in La Crosse, and the amount of impact that we get from other organizations that honestly do understand the link between their employees, the link between keeping people in the community and investing and spending money in the La Crosse area, and how that relates to affordable housing is pretty amazing to me. And so people, they get it. They get it, and they help support it in ways that they can. So, you know, we get people who make donations or will, you know, donate their time, donate materials to make these programs happen. And I think that's kind of one of the biggest strengths that we have in La Crosse is we have really great people that are talking about affordable housing. People understand those links, and they're working hard to try and do what they can to make these projects happen.
Liz, do you think it's going to take more buy-in from businesses, from employers in the community to move the needle on this issue?
I do. You know, we need everybody working on it. And employers really do have a lot of skin in this, making sure that their employees are healthy and able to come to work. You know, any minor setback is loss in productivity, which means loss for the company. So I see a lot of employers that are very interested and, you know, even just want to know how they can do more. So we're getting a lot of people coming to the table, and it's really good to see because it does take the whole community.
I'm glad you brought up this issue of lost productivity, because when we recently held a conversation about how access to affordable child care is impacting the workforce, you know, people working in this area found that there was a cost to local businesses when parents are spending work hours to try to find child care for their families. And, you know, I wonder, Jason, do we have any, you know, sense of the economic cost, the community cost of not having stable housing situations?
Yeah, I think we do. The Seven Rivers Alliance, you know, has been studying this through the WISE plan, and they anticipate that in the next decade we're going to need as many as 2,000 people to come into our labor market to fill the gap that is occurring. And, of course, that is not uniquely attributed to one job classification. It's across the entire economy. But you can imagine that 2,000 people in a labor market of 30,000 is a very significant number every year of people that we're going to need. So we look at, you know, the labor participation rate as well as the unemployment rate, which are, we have a high labor participation rate and a low unemployment rate, and realizing that the amount of housing that we have in the city, we've got about, I think about 22,000 housing units in the city right now, but we've only got about a 2 to 2.5% vacancy rate. That's only freeing up about 400 units, theoretically, are turning over every year. Well, if you're hiring 2,000 people, or you need to have 2,000 people come onto the labor market annually, and you think about the population per household of about 2.2, that means we're going to have about 1,000 housing units available annually if we're going to attract and backfill that many employees. And the city right now is only, our net gain every year is only about 75. We have peaks and valleys because when a big building, like an urban type of building, opens up, of course we get a peak. But then when you look at demolitions and other factors of housing units going away, our net gain every year is only averaging about 75. So that's not enough to keep up with the amount of workers that we really need to attract to this labor market. And back to your question about productivity, you know, I think that it's going to have a very significant effect because those job needs are very real. We talk with businesses every week about this issue and the fact that they're having trouble finding people or filling their interview schedules.
Do you think the city does a good job of looking at this issue of housing across the income brackets?
I think we sure try. I mean, we've done some very creative things with, like, the, you know, renovation of Roosevelt School or the Bacalars building or the new, you know, working with Impact 7, which is a low-income housing tax credit developer on the Kane Street Garden project. So we're trying. I think where we have challenges is just in the characteristics of an urban setting, you know, where you've got, it's very difficult to assemble land. And you've got regulatory barriers, which we're actually looking at. You know, how can we streamline targeted redevelopment nodes to make it easier for developers to assemble land and to actually build more of a variety or a mix of housing that best meets the community's needs in terms of affordability? And then we have gap needs and capital, and that's where maybe the businesses could, you know, help find creative ways to solve that in the interest of attracting workers. And the city has some funding for that gap need, too, in tax incremental financing and community development block grant money and things like that. What I'd like to see us use that more effectively is the old model is, you know, the return on investment for every dollar that the public puts into a project has typically been job creation and tax increment. But what more can we do? We could maybe ask for food forests, you know, so people have access to fresh food on the site that the development is occurring. And actually, we have some developers that are starting to do that in the community. We could also ask for amenities for transit or for bicycling, which we do also to a certain extent. But there are more things. Or we could incentivize clean energy or efficient energy systems that are based on renewable that actually drive some of those household budgets down. So that's the kind of creativity I think we're going to have to exercise in the future with these projects.
Kaya, how do some of these issues that Jason has brought up, you know, access to land within the city, you know, and, you know, facing regulations, how have those impacted Habitat's work, I wonder?
In the last couple of years, it's become much more difficult to find properties in the city of La Crosse that are affordable to purchase in order for redevelopment on Habitat's end. You know, as kind of the economy has improved, there's a lot of other developers that are out there that are kind of part of the whole, you know, game of developing housing. And so it's difficult for affordable housing developers to get in to the city and to get lots and to start building. So it's been something that over the last couple of years has become a much bigger challenge for Habitat for Humanity and for other low-income housing developers. And it's just something that, you know, I think we're going to have to be able to be willing and find the resources to invest more money into these projects in order to make them happen. Whereas, you know, a few years ago, we were able to get land donated by the city or we were able to find other opportunities, and it's just not there anymore.
Can you talk a little bit about how many homes on average Habitat, makes available per year and, kind of what the cost is for Habitat to do these sorts of projects?
Because of the need for affordable housing in our community, we talked as a board and as a community, and we went from building about 1.5 homes per year to a goal by next year to build 6 homes per year. So we constructed 5 homes this past year. We already have 6 homes underway for 2019. What that means, though, obviously, is that there's more resources that are needed in order to make that impact. There's such a need. We're being responsive to it, but our houses cost money. You know, we have a model where we use volunteer labor to construct the majority of the work that's done on the homes, but there's still an actual cash cost for our homes. And so it costs about $120,000 to $130,000 per home in order to make that happen. And so, the impact and the support from the community is greater than ever in order to be able to address and respond to the needs of the community. So we are looking at the community and looking at these partnerships in order to make this goal of 6 homes per year a possibility for our community. And I think it's just imperative that we continue on that. You know, one home a year is just not making that impact. There are plenty more families. There's people on waiting lists for our services, and we need to be responsive to that.
Kaya Fox, Executive Director of the La Crosse Area Habitat for Humanity, is here with us today to talk about the availability of affordable housing in and around La Crosse and how this issue is impacting the local workforce. Also joining us are Jason Gilman, Director of Planning and Development for the City of La Crosse, and Liz Evans, Community Impact Director of Great Rivers United Way. Coming up, we'll talk about how community leaders are working to address the shortage of affordable housing. You're listening to Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Hope Kerwin. To hear audio archives of today's show, visit our website, wpr.org/newsmakers. Our site has archives of other past editions of Newsmakers, and if you'd like to share comments or make suggestions for future shows, you'll find links to our producers and staff. That and more at wpr.org/newsmakers. From Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse, this is Newsmakers. I'm Hope Kerwin. The La Crosse housing market continues to see high demand for homes for sale and rent. This demand has an impact on prices, which in turn impacts where individuals and families at lower income brackets can live. A recent survey of regional business executives found affordable housing has become a top issue they see impacting the workforce. And it's the topic of today's conversation as we take a deep dive into the challenges keeping people from entering and remaining in the local workforce. Joining us to talk about how community leaders are working to address this issue are Jason Gilman, Director of Planning and Development for the City of La Crosse, Liz Evans, Community Impact Director of the Great Rivers United Way, and Kaya Fox, Executive Director of the La Crosse Area Habitat for Humanity. Jason, how have we seen demand for purchasing homes versus demand for rental properties? You know, what do those two kind of demands look like? And, you know, how do they kind of influence each other, I imagine?
Yeah, they're equal. I mean, they're both important. It gets back to that whole idea of having a mix of opportunity for people that are sort of stratified to meet the demographic of what people's income levels are, what kind of access to funding they have to cover their housing costs. But one thing we do see in La Crosse is we have a higher than state average rental category in housing. I think we're up around 65% or so. And some people attribute that, of course, to the higher education institutions, but we are seeing a lot of property that could be owner-occupied converting to rental. And this was something discovered by the University of Wisconsin Extension and looking at who's filing the lottery credit forms. And then we can further study it through geographic information systems to see where the owner's address doesn't match the actual address of the property. So we have a pretty good idea of what's a rental and what's not. One of the concerns we have about that is not only the capacity of people to be good landlords and to make sure that the property is invested in and kept up, but the economic mobility of the tenant too, because if we have a better mix of owner-occupied and rental, it gives our emerging workforce opportunities to buy and build equity, and then long-term they have more economic mobility. So it is concerning when we see the balance tip too far in one direction or the other. We've got to have a good mix. There isn't a magic formula for that, but I've been promoting staying closer to 50-50 if we can and trying to promote more home ownership.
How can the city influence that percentage?
It's a very difficult thing to influence. When you look across the country at techniques that cities have used to influence owner occupancy, the unrelated rule or the definition of family, which is pretty tightly controlled by HUD and very, very difficult to enforce. Over occupancy of non-related people is a real conundrum in terms of enforcement. Then there are some cities that use residential parking permits as a means of applying pressure, because if somebody is renting a structure and it's over-occupied, they don't have access to the number of parking permits that they might need to actually make that home viable or desirable for tenants. Other cities have tried zoning overlay districts. Some cities have ventured, nearer to probable legal challenges in terms of actually tightly controlling how much rental housing can be delivered invested in within a certain block of the city. But most cities tend to use a mix of different things. And we've been somewhat harmed by recent state legislation, too, that has affected our rental registration and inspection program in Act 317, because that was something that actually leveled the playing field in terms of what was expected from potential investors or landlords. And now that we don't have access to those tools, it becomes an even harder thing to influence. Now there are some that would say that we ought to just leave it to the free market, but there is a significant public consequence to that, because the data shows that single family rented property is valued at less by assessment records than single family owner occupied. So that shifts the tax burden, of course, and a number of other things in the city, and makes it more difficult for the city to deliver services and be more financially sustainable. So we have to always have our eye on the consequences of, free market versus some influence in the market.
Yeah, and Liz, I wonder if you could dig a little deeper into the impact that, the higher percentage of people who are, in having to rent versus being able to purchase a home, how that can have other economic impacts on them.
Sure. Well, in the county of La Crosse, 46% of those who are renting are paying more than 30% of their income for that rent. So that's a good portion of their resources that are already taken up just to pay for housing. That means that they don't have as much left over for other goods, services, and resources that help make our community economically viable. If people are struggling already and then one little emergency happens, a medical issue, a car breakdown, then we have people spiraling down and things get worse for them.
And Kaya, I wonder also if the high demand for properties to convert them into rentals, if that impacts the work that you guys do.
Well, I think it absolutely does. First of all, it makes it more difficult for us to acquire property. We're competing with everybody on the open market, and we're in competition with landlords who are purchasing properties. And so we are paying a higher premium for houses that we're going to rehabilitate or land that we're going to redevelop on. And that's been an issue that's been growing over the years. I think the second thing that we see is a lot more people applying and interested in the Habitat programs and other nonprofits who are doing affordable housing development. We are seeing much more people looking at that stability of owner-occupied ownership being able to kind of achieve that American dream and be a homeowner. We have right now 148 people on a waiting list that has been developed in less than 9 months. This is record numbers. We've never seen these number of people interested in our programming. And what we see from the families that are applying to our programs is, you know, exactly that, that they're paying an exorbitant amount of their monthly income for the rent. And they just can't do it anymore. They can't make ends meet. They can't pay the rest of their bills. And they're tired. You know, they're tired of trying to juggle that. We also see a lot of families that are moving over and over and over again in order to be able to try and find that stable housing for their families. They're seeing their rents increases to the point that they can't afford it anymore, so they're moving. So we have families that come in with children who in the past 2 or 3 years have moved 5 or 6 times. And that's not stability. That's not good for children. That's not good for family structure. And so we're seeing a lot more of that with the people who are coming into the program. And I think that's just a, you know, testament to what we're talking about today, is that need for affordable housing, not just rental housing, but also the ability for families to be able to make that step into home ownership and being able to find them homes that are affordable.
Jason, earlier you mentioned just how homes in the floodplain. And I wonder, I know that the city has been looking at this issue of homes in the floodplain and how requirements for flood insurance can have a negative impact on homeowners and that property there. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about, you know, how you guys are looking at homes in the floodplain and the impact of flood insurance.
Yeah, that's a, well, we have 1,200 homes in the floodplain and $120 million in real estate value in the what they call the special flood hazard area, which is the area that is regulated and typically the area where banks will require flood insurance if you're taking out a mortgage. So that's a lot of real estate and a lot of homes. And we launched a grant program a few years back to see whether or not we could entice people to actually improve their own structure. At the time, it was a 50-50 match, up to $20,000 that the city would contribute. And what we found was that very few people are using it, and it's largely because of the requirements that FEMA sets forth in terms of getting a letter of map revision, actually elevating a structure out of the floodplain. Most of the time, it means, you know, moving your furnace and water heater out of the basement, possibly filling your basement with sand, and just people just weren't interested in doing it, not only because of the cost, but because of the disruption in their life. So the people that are using the grant program are ones that are tearing down obsolete homes or blighted homes and actually rebuilding a new home. We've had about 4 of those. So it's not fast and furious. There's challenges associated with the floodplain in terms of redevelopment. But we're actually setting out, we've got 2 grant applications in right now to do a flood hazard mitigation plan and a redevelopment plan that'll help to inform us where are the best areas for land assembly for redevelopment. And we have to consider the location of the infrastructure too, the pipes and streets and sidewalks, because if we just perch homes up high above the street, that's not going to work very good for driveway grades and stormwater planning and things like that. So it's a very expensive endeavor, but it's also one that could be incredibly meaningful to the city in terms of establishing new neighborhoods with green infrastructure and affordability and environmental sustainability in mind, energy efficiency, access to transit, all those things that can contribute to more economic security for people that live in the city. So it's a wonderful opportunity, but it's got its challenges in terms of funding and planning.
That's Jason Gilman, Director of Planning and Development for the City of La Crosse, here with us today to talk about how community leaders in the Cooley region are working to address a lack of affordable housing. He's joined by Kaya Fox from the La Crosse Area Habitat for Humanity and Liz Evans from Great Rivers United Way. You're listening to Newsmakers on Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Hope Kerwin. And Jason, I also wanted to touch on another effort by the city, in addition to community partners, looking at the issue of homelessness in the city. And I just wonder how that specific effort is also kind of playing into the way the city is planning and looking at affordable housing for everyone.
Yeah. Well, this is another one of those topics that is many hands, hearts, and minds. And, of course, my colleagues at the table today are involved in it as well. And but we need real data about homelessness. And we have people that are, you know, doing field surveys that are getting to know people that are homeless in the community or on the verge of homelessness. We have, you know, chronically homeless and then people that are kind of tipping in and out of homelessness. So there, it's not a, I think one of the misunderstandings people have with homelessness is it's not a uniform demographic. Liz says something that I think is really worth repeating, and that is that it can be something as small as your car breaking down or you not being able to get to work that can tip the balance, and you know, and we're cognizant of that. I mean, I think we have to find, that's one of the reasons that when we plan for housing for people, we're trying to put them in areas where they have access to food and access to public transit so that they don't have those types of insecurities or they've got things that they can rely on that can help them transition into a more stable economic situation. But we, when, particularly when we do public-private partnerships like the Roosevelt School Project or the Bachelors Project, or we look for opportunities to use both public capital and tax credits and then the expertise of our partner developers to build a kind of a strata. And the Bachelors building down by Gunderson Health Systems has units available for people that have been homeless and actually gets them into a more stable condition. That's one example of several that we've done like that. So it is something that's on our mind, and we want to be able to be part of the solution.
Yeah, Liz, I wonder if you could talk a little bit more about how, you know, the people that you guys are looking at in this Atlas report, you know, how quickly that can end up in a homelessness situation.
Right. With these households that are in the Atlas population, they are literally on the edge. And, you know, any little thing can help, you know, send them over. One of the things, though, I really want to talk about is when dealing with the homeless folks in our community, one of the great efforts that we've seen is having a lot of folks that are there to help people manage resources, you know, case management, and having that person beside you, not just, you know, putting you in a place and then they're good, but having that additional support, following a person in order to navigate all of the resources and really get back on their feet has been one of the important components of the homeless work that's been going on.
Yeah. Do you think we've seen more kind of coordination among resources when looking at this issue?
Definitely. It's, you know, not only because it's a good thing to do, but because HUD has demanded it, we're seeing, you know, coordinated entry where everybody who is entering into the homeless system is getting the same assessment and being able to tell, you know, who is most at risk and being able to get people to any program that has an opening. It has been a wonderful innovation in helping people get the resources that they need.
Jason, you mentioned you know, projects like the apartments that are in the old Bachelors building and a former school in the La Crosse area. I mean, what evidence do we have that those kinds of projects are working?
Well, I think it's the constant dialogue we have with people that are involved in this subject matter and looking at data and metrics and, you know, are we making a difference? From what I understand, we are. I mean, the mayor has talked about being at functional zero with regard to veterans homelessness, and that means that there are enough units for the people that are homeless that we know of in the city. They have access to those units, and I think we have to continue to look at the data and the metrics to make sure that we are designing our projects and looking at our projects through the right lens and making sure we have opportunities for people to get stable, you know, to have a stable economic situation. And so that's all I guess I would say, is just that we've got to keep our eye on the data.
Kaya, what do you think is going to be the next challenge for the, you know, this community when looking at the issue of affordable housing?
I think there's a lot of things we need to keep our eye on. I think it's always important to remember, you know, how affordable housing and how housing in general just plays into the economic stability of a community, neighborhood, a household. And don't forget those pieces when we're talking about what we need to do as we move forward. I think the other thing that we're going to be taking a look at is the idea of aging in place, older populations and housing needs that they have, and being able to be receptive and responsive to that. And then I think, too, you know, as we are getting farther into the housing development, just making sure that we're staying on top of the idea of maintaining adherence to energy efficiencies and saving money, because I think that's another piece of affordability for families, is making sure that we are, you know, being true to our environment and making sound construction decisions when we're building housing.
This issue of aging in place and you know, older folks being kind of, a part of this conversation, Jason brought up this issue earlier. And, you know, Liz, do we have an understanding of how many, you know, how often people who are older are in this sector of needing access to affordable housing?
I personally don't have a whole lot of data on that, but, you know, anecdotally, we're funding programs that help people stay in their homes, and it's been quite successful in a growing need. We've got, you know, a growing population of folks that are over age 65, and not all of them are going to want to be in assisted living or nursing home. And I see it as a great benefit for people to be able to age in place and having those services available. But when their housing costs, you know, they're on a fixed income, and if housing costs are an issue already, they're going to be running into problems too. So it's just something to also keep an eye on amongst everything else.
Jason, what is the ideal scenario? Because I imagine the community doesn't want to fix the housing issue and go too far where we have too many housing units available in the city. I mean, I imagine that could also have a negative impact. So how do we find that ideal scenario?
Well, I think it gets back to the Alice Report and some of the good work that's been done relative to how do you provide a great quality of life for people. When the Center for Cities did a study on why people live where they live, and they found that younger people in particular are more interested these days in social connections and amenities in cities than perhaps just the allure of salaries, you know, that they're making decisions based on a variety of different factors. However, I would say that economic stress plays in, you know, a large part in whether or not you have a good quality of life or not, or you're worried every month, you know, about making ends meet. So that's where housing comes in, that, you know, we have to look at our demographic and make sure that we're inspiring, you know, the tools that government uses to try to help create a more stable and happy population that has a good quality of life are typically regulatory. So our we have to analyze, do we have regulatory barriers in terms of getting housing built that the community needs? And then we have financial tools. So what does the public want to invest in? What do they want to inspire with public dollars in terms of return on investment? Is it things like a more sustainable city environmentally, food forests, energy efficiency, all those types of things? That conversation has to be had. And then the education and awareness piece, the data, is so important to us. So we know, like you asked about the aging population, we know half of our housing units by U.S. Census data are occupied by people over age 55. So what does that mean in terms of market supply and demand in the future if our birth rate is sagging and our birth rate and death rate are actually on a collision course? Are we actually eventually going to have too many homes on the market in the La Crosse area? And some people would just say, well, that's market risk, and you know the developers have to take that. But I think we can be really smart about how we build housing so that people have the opportunity to age in place, to stay in neighborhoods, to be close to transit, close to services, things like that. And that will insulate the city from that type of market volatility that we might be worried about. And then I think it's a community conversation. We've got to have our partners, our businesses, our nonprofits involved in this to find good solutions.
We've been talking with Jason Gilman, Director of Planning and Development for the City of La Crosse, Liz Evans, Community Impact Director of the Great Rivers United Way, and Kaya Fox, Executive Director of the La Crosse Area Habitat for Humanity, about access to affordable housing in and around La Crosse and how the issue is impacting the local workforce. And that's Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Hope Kerwin. The executive producer for Newsmakers is John Gatto, and our senior news editor and producer is John Davis. If you missed part of today's show, you can find the audio archives at wpr.org/newsmakers.